From KCRW and McSweeney's, this is The Organist. I'm Andrew Leland. Today, we'll hear from two artists whose work investigates the growing prevalence of surveillance in societies around the world. Both Lawrence Abu Hamdan and Trevor Paglen approach their art as investigations. They see themselves as detectives, trying to document through sound and image the corporate and the governmental operations, like surveillance, like secret prisons, that are difficult for us to see or hear. We'll start today's show with Lawrence Abu Hamdan. Our producer, Ross Simonini, was attending an art biennial in the Middle East. He was there to show some of his own work, and he came across one of Abu Hamdan's singular sound installations. And here, I'll let Ross explain.
Sharjah is one of the seven emirates in the United Arab Emirates, and is known for being a kind of cultural center for the Middle East. Compared to the nearby city of Dubai, Sharjah feels traditional and modest, concerned less with commerce than with religion. I saw more mosques and fewer skyscrapers. I was there to exhibit some of my own work at the biennial. The art festival spreads out across the city. There are exhibitions on scorching hot rooftops, in white-walled air-conditioned galleries, and in one dirty, abandoned planetarium. After several days of exploring the biennial, I discovered a harrowing sound installation playing in a darkened room off a small, sun-bleached courtyard. The piece I heard was called Sidnaya, the Missing 19 dB. That's dB as in decibels, the standard measure for the volume of sound. Commissioned specially for the biennial, the 13-minute piece offers a sharp and uncompromising depiction of Sidnaya, a military prison in Syria. It's a compound in the mountains just north of Damascus, holding up to 20,000 people. And it's an atrocity, an outrageous violation of human rights. In a February 2017 statement, Amnesty International reported that the Syrian authorities have, quote, quietly and methodically organized the killing of thousands of people in the prison's custody, and that the murder, torture, enforced disappearance and extermination carried out at Sidnaya since 2011 have been perpetrated as a part of an attack against the civilian population. Abu Hamdan's sound installation helped me to understand these prisoners' confinement. They were held in total darkness and restricted to total silence, almost never allowed to speak. He made the piece through interviews conducted in Istanbul with five survivors, in coordination with Amnesty International and a research group called Forensic Architecture, based at Goldsmiths, University of London. His work often uses the tools of investigative journalism, and it's marked by a deep sense of empathy and listening. He sometimes calls himself a private ear, as opposed to a private eye. Today, Abu Hamdan's piece is making its podcast premiere here on The Organist. And one last note, the piece is upsetting on many levels, so young or sensitive listeners may want to skip ahead. Also, it begins with a loud, very assaulting sound, so brace yourself. We'll give you a moment to turn down the volume. After the opening, the piece resumes at a normal level.
Boeing 737 aircraft at 1 nautical mile before landing. 149 glass bottles crash into the back of a garbage disposal truck. A freight train passes through Utrecht train station. A food processor blending 8 raw carrots. A vacuum cleaner on thick pile carpet. The highway at 10 a.m. New York State. The hubbub of conversation at an Indian restaurant in Manchester. Music playing in the lobby of a 3-star hotel in Istanbul. A couple discuss their plans for the next day while sitting in a central Paris apartment. Frogs croaking throughout the Amazon rainforest in 2010. The few surviving species of frog croaking throughout the Amazon rainforest in 2017. A Swiss Alpine luxury retreat hotel and spa. The Chernobyl exclusion zone. Sidnaya, the Syrian regime prison, 30 kilometers north of Damascus.
A Inside Naya, silence is the master. There's a lot of silence. You can't raise your voice. You can only whisper. And silence is what allows you to hear everything. All you hear in the silence is the guard creeping slowly. Some of the guards would take off their shoes so their footsteps wouldn't make a sound. So we'd be in our cells whispering. He wouldn't know he was listening to us, and all of a sudden you'd hear a... and the beating start. The beating slices through the silence entirely. You'd be there in total silence for 2 hours, and then all of a sudden you hear... the shaft opens and the beatings begin. You hear the beatings, but you don't hear the voices of those being beaten. To scream while you're being beaten is forbidden. In other prisons, the guards wouldn't leave the prisoner alone until he screams. But Said Naya is totally opposite. If you scream, the beatings would intensify. So we could always know if there were new arrivals to the prison, if you hear their screams of pain. There isn't a single voice to be heard throughout the entire building. If they are killing someone, you will not hear their voice. All that can be heard is the sound of the whip and the other instruments of torture striking their bodies. If you make any sound with your voice, even a cough, the guard would barge in demanding to know who coughed. The guard would ask one of us, and he would give the guard the name of someone else, because the guy who coughed is sick. If they hit him, he'll die. Sometimes, no matter how many times he'd ask, no one would answer him. And then he would beat all of us. Once in the cell across from ours, the guards heard the voice of a man whispering. We heard him say, "Who made the sound? Come forward, or I'll kill you all." One of the detainees confessed, and the guard said, "I'm going to take you to the angel of death." All we could hear were hits landing on his body from a distance without a single cry of pain. The hits were so brutal, eventually it stopped. We heard him say, "I emptied out a spot for you so you can get more comfortable in there. I took your friend to the angel of death. Whoever wants to join him, I'll send you over there too." Let's all be quiet for a minute. Turn that off. This is how quiet it was in our cell.
In this silence, detainees develop an acute sensitivity to sound. As they very rarely leave the confines of their cell, survival at Said Naya depends on learning to use sound to map the movements of the guards throughout the prison. The constant fear of an impending attack makes every footstep sound like a car crash. At the times when the guards were in closest proximity, detainees were afraid to audibly move in the cell or to even scratch an itch. Those too sick to suppress a cough break the violently enforced silence and suffer potentially fatal consequences. The silence is testimony to the uninhabitable conditions of Said Naya's overcrowded cells. The silence is a form of torture in and of itself.
No, it's lower than that. That's it.
As the prison is still in operation and access is completely denied, the only way to measure the silence of Said Naya is through the memories of its former detainees.
But my hearing is now a third of what it used to be since I was inside Naya. I don't rely on it as much now. I am exposed to so much more noise these days, and I could be remembering it even louder than how it truly was.
To access this deathly silence, we must listen to both the testimony of the survivors and to the way the silence is stored in the muscle memory of their voices.
When I came out of Saidnaya, I used to speak like someone with a twisted tongue. After whispering for so long, my tongue wasn't used to speaking loudly. Speech was very difficult for me.
The level at which detainees could whisper and not be heard by the guards through the doors, walls, water pipes and ventilation systems is a measure of the silence at Saidnaya. The whisper maps the threshold of audibility. The border between whisper and speech, between sound and silence, is the border between life and death. I asked each of the survivors to listen to the sound of a test tone and to match the volume of the tone with the level at which they could whisper to one another in their cells. A barely audible tone of whisper was consistent among Salam, Samer, and Jamal, but Diab's whisper was 19 decibels greater, the equivalent of being four times louder than the rest. 19 decibels is the difference between a jackhammer carving up a pavement and a dishwasher rinsing food off a plate. Diab's whisper was 19 decibels louder than the rest because he was released in 2011. When all the inmates of Saidnaya were freed in order to use the prison exclusively for the political protesters that were starting a revolution across the country. As a response to these protests, a new era of extreme violence and terror took hold at Saidnaya. A mass murder that can be measured in whispers.
Salman. Diab. Salman. Diab. Salman. Diab. Salman.
The 19 decibel drop in the capacity for inmates to whisper is a measure of the huge increase in violence at Saidnaya since 2011.
Diab.
A 19 decibel increase in violence that has resulted in the killing of 17,000 people, either by execution, hunger, thirst, or untreated illnesses.
Salman.
A 19 decibel drop in whispers that allows us to hear loud and clear the transformation of Saidnaya from a prison into a death camp.
Salman.
Okay. Silence is what allows you to hear everything.
Salman.
What we figured out from the sounds were that every 10 to 15 days, the guards would take a selection of prisoners out of each cell of the prison.
ويطلعوا المساجين
You would hear them open the doors of each of the cells to take them out and gather them all and put them in the first two cells of our ring. We would hear the guard saying, lie on top of one another. Once we counted that they had crammed 300 men into one cell. They gathered them here, and they keep them crammed inside until the middle of the night. We'd start to fall asleep, and then we wake up to the noise of the door of their cell opening, and the guards cursing and beating them. At around 5 in the morning, they'd collect them, put them in trucks, and we would hear the trucks drive off. I would count how many trucks come and go throughout the night. Once I remember the truck came 10 times. Each time it would park. They would fill it up with prisoners and then drive off. We decided to memorize the names of the prisoners that we heard the guards call out so that if ever we go out, we could ask about them. We asked about them and none of the men were taken to any civil prisons. We don't know where they went. They have disappeared. We would hear the trucks drive off and it would be silent for 15 minutes. And then we would hear the truck return empty. So the sound of these trucks leaving and the 15 minutes of silence until we heard them coming back empty, this was the sounds of executions.
Amnesty International published an interactive digital model of Sednaya Prison online. We'll put a link to that, as well as a link to more of Abu Hamdan's work, on our website, which is kcrw.com/theorganist. Coming up, we'll speak with Trevor Paglen, who makes artwork using state-of-the-art mass surveillance technology. We'll be right back.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
And now, our producer Ross Simonini speaks with the multimedia artist Trevor Paglen.
Trevor Paglen takes photographs of satellites, launches sculptures into geostationary orbit, and collects uniform patches from clandestine military units. For Paglen, each of these projects is an effort to reveal the ways that governments and corporations devise, refine, and implement control over their citizens and consumers. Paglen holds a PhD in geography, and much of his art explores the politics of land use. He wants to show the relationship that secret military bases have with the surrounding landscape. Sites in the middle of the desert, or national security offices, looming like castles, not far from suburban neighborhoods in Virginia and Maryland. He photographs places that the average citizen has never seen, places we aren't supposed to see. And he does so from long distances, up to 40 miles away, which is sometimes as close as he can get without breaking the law. Because of this distance, Paglen uses telescopic equipment that is designed for astronomers, and the photos can end up looking abstract, just bands of color and light illuminating the darkened functions of the military. He's especially interested in making visible the American governmental institutions that are dedicated to spying and surveillance, the ones who watch their people, us, through our computers and phones, supposedly for our own protection. Paglen says it's his way of watching the system that watches us. He wants to make art that exposes the truth of the current moment, and for him, this is a moment of secrecy and surveillance. He attributes the rise of the contemporary surveillance state to the internet, which has become a profound tool for gathering data on large populations, frequently without their knowledge. The rising technology of artificial intelligence is a particularly useful tool for crunching massive amounts of data, interpreting millions of photographs, and assembling in-depth profiles of individuals. For a recent performance called Sight Machine, Paglen harnessed the artificial intelligence algorithms used on the internet by such companies as Google. He brought them out into the open to demonstrate their abilities and their limitations. For the performance, he collaborated with Kronos Quartet, a string quartet who has played a vast repertoire of music, from Terry Riley to Tom Waits. As the quartet performed at Pier 70 in San Francisco, Paglen used AI to visually deconstruct their performers on movie screens, transforming them into panels of digits and charts. But by the end of the concert, it was clear to the audience that the old-fashioned technology of the string quartet could perform ineffable feats that machines could never attain.
What's happening during the performance is that there's cameras kind of surrounding them, and those cameras are attached to computers that are running a whole suite of different computer vision algorithms, artificial intelligence algorithms, you know, looking at really the whole history of computer vision. So in one song, they'd be performing and it would be attached to an imaging system that was used for guided missiles. And so those, we were making images that show you as an audience how a particular algorithm is seeing that performance, and then that's projected behind them. So in the concert, you're watching them perform, and at the same time, you're watching them perform as they are seen through different computer vision algorithms. And what I was really trying to do with that was to highlight that tension between these kind of emerging machinic and automated forms of vision and, you know, understanding and putting that into tension with a kind of more human-to-human forms of communication. And I thought music was really the perfect way to do that, because when you're performing music, you are doing something that's very affective. You know, a music kind of hits you in your body in a way that is kind of circumvents rationality in a way. It's something that is really irreducible to anything that you could articulate with words or with reason on one hand. On the other hand, it's something that's deeply cultural. You know, when you're performing music, you are in a way kind of channeling your ancestors. There's thousands and thousands of years of human history that has gone into the creation of these artworks, and you kind of manifest them and materialize them temporarily in that space when you do that. So there's this kind of overwhelming cultural history and affective things going on that are, you know, really far outside the domain of what you're able to do with automated forms of vision and with kind of ubiquitous sensing and surveillance. And so really pointing out that gap, or exploring that gap, was really what that performance was about for me.
And are we encountering these AI algorithms in our daily lives at this time? I mean, is this the kind of thing that we're experiencing? You had mentioned on Facebook, maybe some of these are being used. Are there other ways in which we're bumping up against these all the time?
Absolutely. I mean, these kinds of data analytics are becoming more and more ubiquitous, used in everything from industrial processes to looking at energy efficiency to trying to, again, sales and marketing. I think probably the next thing that's coming is using it for insurance and credit, that sort of thing. And what this is quickly adding up to is a world in which, and this is something that I am deeply concerned about, is adding up to a world in which your rights and freedoms really are being constantly modulated by your behaviors and the ways in which your behaviors are interpreted by companies that have very specific kinds of agendas. Today, that's, you know, trying to sell you something, but tomorrow, that could be trying to, modulate your health insurance premium on a day-to-day basis based on whether you went to the gym or not, based on what, you know, whether you're drinking Coke or beer or something like that, or eating junk food in pictures of you that are online, that sort of thing. And that's coming, I think. And that's a great deal of cause for concern, I think, because that adds up to, ultimately, I think, a very undemocratic society, a society that is going to encourage kind of extreme conformity and really exacerbate existing social inequalities.
How available is this technology to the rest of us?
Well, one of the fascinating kind of seemingly ironic things about a lot of these software tools is that many of them are open source, right? So we're using the same exact, you know, packages that Google would use or Facebook would use. What's actually more valuable in a way than the software is the training data that you have, right? So Facebook can recognize anybody in the world's face who's on Facebook at a far greater rate of accuracy than a human could recognize that person's face. And why can they do that? They can't do that because their facial recognition algorithm is so much better than anybody else's. They can do that because they have so many more pictures of everybody else than anybody else has, right? And so you need these enormous training sets to do very efficient work in artificial intelligence. And the people that have that training data are the big, you know, companies, is the Microsofts, the IBMs, the Googles, the Facebooks, the Amazon, really. And that's what makes those companies have so much more power in this domain than many other ones.
So a lot of the examples you've been using are corporate, but I'm curious what kind of applications are being used by the government at this time, and I wonder how you think this will play out, AI and perhaps surveillance more broadly in the next 4 years.
I think that's a really good question. I mean, one of the kind of major insight that we got into understanding how an institution like the NSA works was obviously with the Snowden releases in 2013. And there was a tremendous amount of information there about how intelligence agencies use, you know, so, quote unquote, big data and so on and so forth. But 2013 at this point is kind of the stone age in terms of how artificial intelligence works. I mean, artificial intelligence, as we know it now, really started getting some legs around 2012. So this is very new stuff, you know, 4 or 5 years ago. And we don't have a Snowden since then, so it's difficult to say how these structures are being used. Now, we do know that line, perhaps, between the kind of corporate side of the world and the law enforcement and national security parts of the state is being constantly negotiated, right? So with Snowden, we saw a program like PRISM where the FBI and NSA could access data from corporations directly. And I think it's pretty likely that you will see a kind of intensification of those relationships. In other words, would Facebook, for example, make a product that would be licensed to law enforcement to do facial recognition? You need these kinds of data sets to work at that scale. And those kind of data sets are something that a local law enforcement agency and probably the FBI is really not going to be able to scale in that same way. So I'd imagine what you'd want to do is to develop those relationships with corporations who do have that data. And this is, you know, ultimately when we're looking at, you know, Apple's fight about the iPhone, you know, trying to unlock the iPhone and that sort of thing. I think that is setting the stage for what this relationship between, you know, law enforcement, national security, and corporate models is going to look like. I mean, there are things that everybody should do in terms of personal, you know, privacy hygiene about, you know, you should download Signal on your phone and use that as an encrypted text messaging application that allows you to do encrypted phone calls as well. That's very basic stuff. You know, I often talk to people and they say, oh, well, we're just giving all our data to Facebook. We're just giving, you know, Google all and Apple all our data by using these phones and we should stop using them. And I don't think that's quite true because, you know, in real life, you're not really going to be able to participate in the society in certain kinds of ways without being able to use these technologies. You know, if you don't have a cell phone, you're going to have a hard time, you know, having a job or having to collaborate with other people and that sort of thing. So I don't think that the answer is opting out on an individual level. I think the answer has to happen at more of a policy level. In other words, there needs to be a kind of first of all, an understanding of the enormous power that these kinds of technologies have, and a long, hard look at the policy level about what kinds of data can be collected, what can it be used for, who has the right to see it, who has the right to use it. And this is something that Europe is definitely further along than the U.S. on. I don't think it's going to happen at the level of individual consumers. And I also don't think it's going to happen at the level of, you know, technology companies themselves. However, you know, there's basic things that I would not do. So I would not put a picture of a child on Facebook, for example, because that child is not given their consent to handing over their kind of metadata signature to a company that you don't know what they're going to do with it in the future. The other thing that I am very conscious about is if I'm researching like a health problem or something like that, I don't do that on Google. I'll do that over something like Tor that does not leave a trace of those searches, because I don't want to, because I don't know how that information is going to be used in the future. I mean, we give extraordinarily intimate details of our lives to companies that are going to do things with that whose implications we really don't understand and have not even been played out yet.
I mean, your primary field of interest has always been geography. And I'm curious how artificial intelligence relates to that.
The way that I think about geography, and it's not necessarily the way that other people do, but the way I think about geography is that it's the study of how human societies kind of shape the surface of the Earth and are in turn shaped by the ways in which we've shaped the surface of the Earth. So to give you a really obvious or, you know, kind of basic example would be agriculture. You know, about 10,000 years ago, agriculture became widespread, and that so that changed the surface of the Earth in terms of humans began kind of picking which species were going to be more successful, planting fields and doing that sort of thing. But it also dramatically changed human societies in the sense that it made human societies more sedentary, kind of staying in one place. It also created surpluses that didn't exist in societies before that. And those surpluses then created opportunities for class stratification in ways that hadn't existed before that. So that's a very kind of simple example of that relationship between humans and the surface of the Earth. And if we fast forward that to something like artificial intelligence and ubiquitous surveillance. Again, we're building infrastructures that are very much part of the Earth's surface, but those infrastructures have politics embedded within them, as it were, in the same way that agriculture kind of has politics embedded within it. There's a certain form of society that those structures tend to encourage and others that they make impossible. And that's one of the things that concerns me about this, is that these systems are being deployed. They're not neutral. They do one of two things for the most part. On one hand, they're furthering capitalist interests. In other words, they're systems that are designed to make money, or they are systems that are designed to enhance law enforcement and military power. And what concerns me is that I'm not sure that those two domains are sufficient to have the kind of society that we want to live in. And so the more ubiquitous these technologies become, the more capitalism will become ever, ever more enmeshed in the kind of molecular kind of structure almost of our lives. And there's something that's lost when that happens.
Trevor Paglen created Sight Machine during his tenure as the inaugural artist-in-residence at Stanford University's Cantor Arts Center. The Organist is produced by me with Ross Simonini. Our managing editor is Ben Bush. Our contributing editors are Jenny Amint, Naila Orr, David Weinberg, and Mike Dodge Weisskopf. Our editor at KCRW is Nick White, and we're mixed at KCRW by Kat Yor and Mario Diaz. I know you know this, but the thing that podcasts need more than anything else is reviews and ratings on the Apple Podcast page. So I urge you to visit our Apple Podcast page and write your own. It could be funny, it can be sad, it can be critical, it can be digressive. Just listen to this new one, posted yesterday by a listener called Vu Tran.
I'm what people call a night owl. When everyone is deep asleep, I'm most awake. After midnight, everything feels more clarified and rich, more conducive to digestion. I write at night, I read at night, I watch movies and the occasional TV show. Around 1 or 2, I enjoy a cigarette on my balcony while listening to something melancholy, like The Cure or Depeche Mode, or if I'm feeling particularly sentimental, The Beach Boys. I usually don't crawl into bed until 4 or 5. I'm in Vermont at the moment, at an artist residency, with woods and mountains surrounding me, brooks and creeks and probably caves somewhere. And for 2 weeks now, I've been taking walks at night by the water or under trees and listening to the organist. Cigarettes in my pocket, unlit flashlight at the ready, both earbuds in. A few nights ago, the organist was playing when I tripped over a rock and fell to the ground, right along the bank of a nearby stream. My earbuds popped out and I found myself suddenly and entirely alone, cut off from those tranquil voices and whatever weirdness of the world they were elucidating. I sat there on the ground for some moments, taking in the moonlit tops of the trees along the opposite bank, the murmuring water between us. Another sound reached me then, from somewhere nearby, like someone humming to themselves. It could have easily been another resident doing the same thing I was. I stood up and lit a cigarette and put my earbuds back in. The familiar voices returned, but I was no longer listening. On the other side of the stream, facing me in the darkness of the trees, I saw what looked like the glow of a cigarette, a red eye suspended in that blackness, continuously appearing, then vanishing. This is too symmetrical, I thought, too symbolic, standing here in the night across the waters from some other version of myself. It made me think of Conrad's The Secret Sharer, and now I imagine this version of myself smoking naked there amid the trees, perhaps after a midnight skinny dip in the stream. I thought of ticks and chiggers, poison ivy, sharp rocks cutting wet bare feet. I flicked on my flashlight and shined it across the way, nothing but swaying tree branches. I turned it off, waited. A minute later, the red eye returned, an eternal ember in the night. The breeze swept goosebumps across my arms and legs, but I don't remember feeling afraid. It was something more like annoyance, that something was interrupting my aloneness, even if that something was some shade of myself. I turned up the volume on my phone until I could no longer hear the stream or my own thoughts, and flicked my cigarette into the water. On the walk back to my room, the organist filled my ears, and I thought of nothing else. It wasn't until I was lying in bed that I realized my knee had been badly scraped, that blood had trickled down my leg in two thin streams and had dried like paint. I didn't clean it off. I just closed my eyes and continued listening to the organist. The scrape on my knee bloomed into a soothing kind of pain, and as I trailed off to sleep, I remember feeling more alive than I had felt in some time.
Vu Tran is the author of the novel Dragonfish, and he's a recipient of a Whiting Award. He teaches creative writing at the University of Chicago. And that was his review of The Organist for Apple Podcasts. Now, get yourself over there and see if you can top Vu. And if you're interested in making some radio of your own, our team at KCRW is chalking up the starting line for their 5th annual 24-hour radio race. You'll have that amount of time to create your very own piece of short audio nonfiction based on a secret topic to be revealed at 10 a.m. on the morning of Saturday, August 19th. To learn more, go to kcrw.com/radio race and be sure to let them know that we sent you. We'll be back with another organist in 2 weeks. Thanks for listening.